Good evening, everybody. I'm Charles Berry, the chairman of the board of the New York Society Library, and I'm very pleased to welcome you here this evening and to introduce Jonathan Steinberg, the author of the best-selling biography of Otto Bismarck, the great leader of Germany who unified that country in the third quarter of the 19th century. Professor Steinberg is a Walter Annenberg Professor of Modern European History at the University of Pennsylvania and one of the world's leading authorities on 19th and particularly 20th century Germany, Italy, Austria, and Switzerland. A former fellow of Trinity Hall at Cambridge University in England, where he lectured for 30 years, Professor Steinberg has written on a wide range of subjects, including fascist Italy, modern Jewish history, and the evolution of modern Europe. He prepared the official report of the gold transactions by Deutsche Bank, Germany's national bank, during World War II. That is, the transactions occurred then, not his preparation of the report. Professor Steinberg has a particular interest and skill in biography, which is heartening to me, not only because biographies have always fascinated me, but also because the Society Library has a particular strength in its collection amassed over 250 years in biography. Among his many other scholarly contributions is a 36-part series of biographies published by The Teaching Company that appears under the title European History and European Lives, 1715 to 1914. And I hope that Professor Steinberg will share some general thoughts on biography and personalities as a way of understanding history. As a fan of modern European history myself, I was always amazed how over the course of 30 years or less, the map of Germany was transformed from a crazy quilt of duchies and principalities with double-barreled names to a sinister behemoth stretching its arms across Poland to the east. The story of how that happened and the key role of one man in that process is set forth in Professor Steinberg's comprehensive and scholarly but readable and absorbing biography of Bismarck. You may have read the glowing review of this book in the New York Times book review section by Henry Kissinger, himself no slouch in matters of history, who no doubt has given at least a fleeting thought to whether he will stand as tall as Bismarck in tomorrow's history books. As with Dr. Kissinger, I commend this fascinating book to all of you. Let me remind you before I turn over the podium to Professor Steinberg that this is the time of year when we encourage our members to support our annual fund, which is critical to our success and makes evenings like this possible. Thank you for your support. I'm delighted to give you Professor Steinberg.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I must thank Sarah Holliday and the New York Society Library for the honor of this invitation tonight, for arranging the event, and then to all of you for selling it out. I'm not accustomed to having sellouts, and it's very, very agreeable, especially on a hot New York evening when you can't get from A to B because the UN is in session. And it's a particular honor to speak in this beautiful mansion, which is one of the finest Renaissance revival buildings in the city, and in an institution which was founded in 1754. Now, 1754, the year in which Thomas Gray published The Progress of Poesy, and the great David Hume, his History of Great Britain, when George II was still King of England, and the French and Indian Wars had not yet begun. 61 years later, on the 1st of April, 1815, Otto Leopold Eduard von Bismarck Schönhausen was born. Between the foundation of this wonderful library and its great tradition and Bismarck's birth, the world changed dramatically. The great revolutions of America and France transformed politics and society on both sides of the Atlantic and introduced those principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity which most threaten the aristocratic order of which Bismarck in his prime became the chief defender. It was Bismarck's, I think, unique ability to use the forces of war and revolution to preserve, solidify, and expand the reactionary system of government in Prussia and in Germany, and to preserve the most important elements of absolute monarchy and the implacable rule of the country nobility known as the Junker class and pass it on into the 20th century. Large chunks of Bismarck's Germany survived into the 20th century and ultimately to 1945. In Law Number 46 of February the 25th, 1947, the Allied Control Council abolished the state of Prussia. The only time in the history of the world, as far as I know, that a recognized state was formally abolished by an international organization. And it has not come back. The Federal Republic of Germany today has as its chancellor an office which Bismarck invented, a person who in gender, charisma, brilliance, and origins is the opposite of Bismarck. As Bismarck's successor, General von Caprivi, sadly observed, Germany ought to be able to get along with ordinary people. And thank God, in Angela Merkel, they found just that. In my eyes, her ordinariness, her common sense, her hopeless lack of style, and her boring speeches are the best hope that the cult of the genius statesman in Germany has been buried for good and a stake driven through its heart. That Bismarck was a genius statesman is, alas, true. He was also the most interesting human being of the 19th century. When he sneezes or says Prosit, the novelist Theodor Fontana wrote, it's more interesting than the speeches of six progressives. Well, maybe not six, and certainly not Edward Lasker or Eugen Richter, who made wonderful speeches, but roughly right. Yet how did he do it? And in answer to Mr. Berry's question, I'm going to try to set him into the context and show you why biography is indeed the only way to understand Bismarck's achievements. Now, in 1862, Otto von Bismarck, not yet Minister President of Prussia, then 47 years old, decided to visit London. Negotiations were going on to make him Minister President, but he was a very doubtful figure. He had a reputation of being intemperate, irrational, extremely right-wing, and dangerous, and the king very naturally hesitated. He had been Prussian ambassador to St. Petersburg since 1859, and for nearly a decade before he had been the Prussian ambassador to the old German Confederation, which Mr. Berry mentioned, composed of lots of small states with double-barreled names. His reputation in diplomatic circles was that of a person capable of eccentric and outrageous behavior and statements. And he lived up to it at a reception in the Russian ambassador's home at which Benjamin Disraeli, then leader of the opposition, future prime minister, was present. Baron Bruno, the Russian ambassador, the Austrian envoy, Friedrich Count Wietstum from Eckstedt, were among the audience. And this is what Disraeli recorded Bismarck as having said. I shall soon be compelled to undertake the conduct of the Prussian government. A statement of such effrontery, he had absolutely no guarantee that would happen at all. My first care will be to reorganize the army, with or without the help of the legislature. As soon as the army shall have been brought into such a condition as to inspire respect, I shall seize the first best pretext to declare war against Austria, dissolve the German Diet, subdue the minor states, and give national unity to Germany under Prussian leadership. I have come here to say this to Her Majesty's ministers, unquote. On the way home, Disraeli walked the Austrian ambassador to his residence. As they parted, Disraeli said to him, take care of that man. He means what he says. And he did. 9 years, almost to the day, a victory parade passed through Berlin after the stupendous Prussian triumph over France in the Franco-Prussian War and the proclamation of a German empire in the euphoria of that success. Otto von Bismarck had accomplished in these 9 years much more than his astonished listeners had heard in London. These years were the greatest diplomatic revolution of the 19th century and perhaps one of the greatest of all times. For Bismarck accomplished all this without commanding a mass movement. He had no political party behind him. Without dominating a vast parliamentary majority. Without the support of the people. Without any previous experience of government. Not a great orator, and with a reputation and name which was loathed in most parts of Germany. This achievement, the work of a political genius of a very unusual kind, rested on several sets of conflicting characteristics, among which you've just heard brutal, disarming honesty mingled with the wiles and deceits of a confidence man. He played his parts with perfect self-confidence, yet mixed them with rage, anxiety, illness, hypochondria, gluttony, and irrationality. And that's for starters. But what moved him? One contemporary, and I'm happy to say an American contemporary, saw something which I think is the real Bismarck, and it doesn't show up very often. This was the young American John Lothrop Motley, and Motley was a proper Bostonian, you know, Boston, home of the bean and the cod, where Cabot speak only to Lowells, and Lowells speak only to God. I did have a Cabot pupil who said, "You got it wrong. Lowells speak to us, and we speak to God." Anyway, he belonged to that set. He was a great friend of Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., and as was common among young Americans of that class, both North and South, they went to Germany to experience the new university, and he went to Göttingen. And there he met Bismarck. First, he met him in an inn before the semester began, where Bismarck was on a beer tour, drinking his way through Germany. And then one day he was walking through Göttingen, and he saw this extraordinary large figure in the middle of the street with two big dogs wearing an extremely weird costume and challenging and provoking everybody he met to a duel or some other kind of contest. Motley reintroduced himself. Bismarck said, "Wait, when I'm finished with this, come back to my room." When they got back to the room, Bismarck told him the following, and I ought to say we know this because John Lothrop Motley went back to Boston, and in 1839, when he was 25 and Bismarck 24, he published a novel about the young German he had met called Morton's Hope, in which the main character, thinly disguised, is Otto von Rabenmark. And when I'm lecturing on Bismarck, I say to my students, who do you know among your fellow students that you would go home and write a novel about? So even at the age of 18, Bismarck was something special. And this is what Bismarck told Motley, according to the character in the novel. "I intend to lead my companions here as I intend to lead them in afterlife. You see, I'm a very rational sort of person now, and you would hardly take me for the crazy mountebank you met in the street half an hour ago. But then I see that this is a way to obtain superiority. I determined at once on arriving at the university that the way to obtain mastery over my competitors, who are all extravagant, savage, eccentric, was to be 10 times as extravagant and savage as anyone else. His age was, at the time I am writing, exactly 18 and a half. Now, it is interesting that, because one or two other times during the course of Bismarck's career, he lets down the facade, and you see this ruthless urge to dominate. But the will to dominate lay behind a charm of speech and manner, a delicious, irreverent sense of humor, a warmth and hospitality that captivated even his opponents. Now, just let me tell you one typical Bismarck incident. There was a rival of his, a man called Robert von der Goltz, a very ill-tempered, very well-connected diplomat, who went to see Bismarck when Bismarck was ambassador in Frankfurt and spent the whole time complaining and being difficult. And as he left Bismarck's house, one of Bismarck's gigantic dogs started to bark at him. And as he walked by the dog, Bismarck stuck his head out of the window and said, "Goltz, don't bite my dog." The people who knew him use words like bewitched, enchanted, charmed, delighted, and fascinated. Disraeli, no mean charmer himself, said in a letter to Sybil Bedford, "He talks as Montaigne writes." And he sat listening to Bismarck for several hours on two occasions, completely hypnotized. As a child, he defended himself against his ambitious and cold mother by telling lies. And he lied consistently all his life, and contemporaries saw that too. On other occasions, as in London or in his college rooms, he told the absolute truth so brutally that people couldn't believe their ears. He could be kind and cruel, emotional and cold, sensitive and heartless, honest and devious. His personality had authority, and another word, along with bewitched and enchanted, which you get again and again and again, is demonic. demonic. Windthorst, the leader of the Catholics, said of him, il est le diable, he is the devil. So this is some person really, really special. He had stupendous intellectual powers. If you look at the 20 volumes of the official edition of Bismarck's letters, you realize he probably wrote more than Dickens or Trollope. And I don't think he ever wrote a boring sentence in his life. When I had to cut the book, I had to cut all kinds of wonderful stuff in order to bring it down to something like its present fat shape. His secretary and first personal assistant, because until 1875 he didn't even have a personal assistant, he ran the German state and the Kingdom of Prussia by himself with his own efforts. His first personal assistant, Christoph von Tiedemann, described a typical day at Bismarck's country home. Quote, yesterday I spent 2.5 hours in his study. Today he dictated the whole afternoon a letter to the emperor, in all 32 folio sides, not interrupted, but written right through. He gave not only an exact account of the negotiations with Bennigsen, this was a time when Bismarck was toying with the idea of bringing liberals into his cabinet, but also a complete and highly political account of the development of our entire party system since the introduction of a constitution. The prince dictated without stopping for 5 hours. I repeat, 5 hours. He spoke more quickly than usual. I could hardly keep up with the flow of thought. The room was overheated, and I began to sweat terribly and thought I might get a cramp. I decided quickly and without saying a word to take off my jacket and throw it over a chair. I continued in shirt sleeves. The prince, pacing up and down, looked at me first in amazement and then nodded at me with understanding and continued without pause to dictate. 5 hours on the trot, without dropping a word, without saying something out of touch. Bismarck had astonishing capacity to pick up information. One of my favorite, which I had to cut, was an account of the English libel laws, which he gave in 1868 when the German Parliament, was interested in extending rights in Germany. It's a perfect example of how English libel laws work today. And I don't know where he got it from. Through Motley, he learned to speak and write pretty good English. But how did he know about English libel laws? Who knows? When he was a kid, he never seemed to do any homework. He just knew everything. Bismarck achieved his feats because of his gargantuan personality, his incredible powers of thought. He was also very large. He was 6'4", and at one stage weighed 270 pounds. There was a lot of him. And the charm of his spoken and written prose disarmed and subdued supporters and opponents alike. But not even the most sovereign of selves can operate successfully without help. And this is an answer to Mr. Berry's question. What is the relationship between Bismarck's personality and the history itself, or between biography and typical history? In Bismarck's case, 4 factors over which he had no control made a tremendous difference. First, the change in the international balance of power. That did not happen. Had nothing to do with him when Louis Napoleon overthrew the standing order by becoming emperor. Second, he was not responsible for the institutional structure of the Kingdom of Prussia after the revolution of 1848. He had no control over that, but he was a master at using it. Third, he certainly could not have foreseen and had nothing to do with the appointment of another genius, General Helmut von Moltke, perhaps the greatest general of the 19th century. The greatest general of the 19th century, to be chief of the Prussian general staff in 1857, and his transformation of the Prussian army, over which Bismarck, as a civilian, could by definition have no control. And finally, he could not have foreseen that there would be a group of extremely engaged evangelical Christians among his Junker neighbors who would look to him as the sword of God who would smite the ungodly because he was such a good speaker. So those 4 things were there. What he did was to use them all. And it's one of the ironies, I think, of Bismarck's story, that had it not been for the revolution of 1848 and the introduction of parliamentary government in its new form, Bismarck would never have had a career because they wouldn't have needed him. Under absolutism, there was nothing for him to do. Once the king needed a minister, and especially a brilliant minister, Bismarck's career became possible. Now, I would love to spend a lot of time on international relations, because it's the context in which Bismarck showed his mastery. But the point I think you need to bear in mind is the revolutions of 1848 put an end to the old reactionary system and changed politics forever. In France, a Bonaparte came to power, and by nature, this Bonaparte had to try to imitate his great uncle, and so he upset a whole series of standing things. Bismarck had no control over that. What he did, though, was to realize that Louis Napoleon Bonaparte had taught him something useful. He got into trouble with his backers, who regarded Louis Napoleon Bonaparte as a red, a revolutionary, and wholly illegitimate. And I want to read you one little passage in Bismarck's letter to his patron Leopold von Gerlach, who had the king's ear, which gives you an idea of how smart Bismarck was. "The present form of government in France is not arbitrary. It's not a thing that Louis Napoleon can correct or alter. It was something that he found as a given, and it's probably the only method by which France can be ruled for a long time to come. For everything else, the basis is missing, either in the national character or has been shattered and lost. If Henry V, that is the Bourbon pretender, were to come to the throne, he would be unable, if at all, to rule differently. Louis Napoleon did not create the revolutionary conditions. He did not rebel against an established order, but instead fished power out of the whirlpool of anarchy as nobody's property. If he were to lay it down, he would greatly embarrass Europe, which would more or less unanimously beg him to take it up again." Now, that was absolutely anathema to the Junkers who had backed him, who, as I say, regarded Louis Napoleon as both illegitimate and a revolutionary. The Prussian state, which he led, was not his creation, nor was he responsible for the peculiar status of the nobility in Prussia. That goes back to a promise made by another great genius, disastrous great genius in German history, Frederick the Great, who realized that the nobility was an essential element in the social structure. And as he explained in his Testament of 1752, "The Prussian nobility has sacrificed its life and goods for the service of the state. Its loyalty and merit have earned it the protection of all its rulers. It is the one goal of policy of this state to preserve the nobility." And when Frederick the Great said that, he was talking about, say, a family like the von Kleist. 30 von Kleists died in the Seven Years' War. When Moltke drew up the order of battle in 1870 for the Franco-Prussian War, the famous names of Prussian history show up in the distribution of commands. There were 3 von Kleists, 3 von der Goltz, 1 Neidhardt von Gneisenau, 2 von Belos, von der Osten, one long, long list of distinguished Prussians commanding in 1870, and when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939, they were still there. So we're talking about a class, the von Tadens, the Senftpilsachs, who became and represented the core of the Prussian state in its military and its administrative system right from the start. Bismarck had as his king William I, 1797 to 1888. And I need to, perhaps to say one other word about what makes my biography a little bit unusual. It dawned on me that everybody who met Bismarck thought he was fantastic. So if you met Bismarck, you went home and wrote about it. And that it would be much more fun for the readers to hear what contemporaries thought about Bismarck than what I think about Bismarck. So the balance between what I say and what the contemporaries say is unusual. There's much more quotation in this book than would normally be the case in a typical biography, because what is really interesting is Bismarck, and the people who knew him wrote about him a lot. And William, they wrote about William too. William was a man for whom I have a soft spot. He was decent, he was honorable, he was hardworking, he was, in fact, a very, very fine human being in all kinds of ways. He was the only German king or emperor, Prussian king or emperor, who was prepared to give to his two geniuses, Bismarck and Moltke, real command. Between 1866 and 1870, for the only time in Prussian German history, General von Moltke commanded the army, because the commander was normally, the commander-in-chief was normally the king or emperor. Moltke was the idol of his troops. Julius von Verdi-Vernois said, "We all feel happy in his company and absolutely love and worship him." Another man who plays a great role in my story is a general not so well known as Moltke, Lieutenant General Albrecht von Roon, for whom I have a very soft spot, 1803 to 1879. Roan made Bismarck's career possible, and he knew it. His best friend, Clement Theodor Perthes, a devout Christian, a professor at the University of Bonn, with whom he had a very intimate correspondence, wrote to him in 1864 to complain about the fact that von Roan had put this unprincipled, unscrupulous, unchristian, in spite of his pretensions, person into power. Roan wrote back and said, "Bismarck is an extraordinary man, whom I can certainly help, whom I can support here and there, and sometimes correct, but never replace. Yes, he would not be in the place he now has without me. That is a historical fact. But even with all that, he is himself." Now, without Roan, Bismarck would have had no career in the Prussian monarchy. Bismarck had tried to get out of compulsory military service because he didn't want to be bored. The documents are on this are omitted from the official collection of his papers because it's so shocking. He had no military credentials beyond a year as a reserve officer in a modest regiment. And in Frederick the Great's Prussia, that was out. Good Prussians went to a Kadettenanstalt, a military school, and then they went into their regiment. Bismarck, because of his bourgeois mother, went to a gymnasium, that is a literary classical high school, and became, oh horrors, a lawyer, not an aristocratic profession. But what happened was that in 1857, Frederick William IV had a stroke, William I became regent and then king, and one of the first things he decided to do on taking office was to reform the army. And he had known Roan and admired him, and he appointed Roan to head a commission to reform the army, and that led to the constitutional crisis with the legislature, which led to Bismarck's appointment. Without Roan, no Bismarck of history. When his friend Perthes accused him of appointing a person, quote, who calculates so coldly, who prepares so cunningly, who has no scruple about methods, Roan replied that, quote, Bismarck assesses the nature and weight of effective forces, which one cannot know precisely. That is the work of a historical genius. So people saw it at the time. And Roan provided one thing that Bismarck could not do for himself. Every flag officer, every commanding general in the Prussian army had immediate access, it was called Immediatstellung, immediate position, to the king, who was their commanding officer. So when Bismarck needed to see the king, Roan had to do it for him. Moreover, when Roan was finally appointed Minister of War, which was a very unusual appointment because he was 17th or something in seniority in the Prussian officer corps, the first thing he said to the king was, Your Majesty, you've got to appoint Bismarck. And the king said, we'll see. And it was only when the crisis over the extension and expense of the army produced a constitutional crisis in which it looked like there might be a second act of the Revolution of 1848 that the king, who was about to abdicate, gave in to Roan and said, well, I'll see Bismarck. I don't think he'll help us, but I will see him. And by the way, it's worth mentioning that the most famous speech that Bismarck ever made, the Blood and Iron speech, which was his first, could easily have been his last. It was a speech he made to the Finance Committee of the Prussian Parliament a week after his appointment. And he said, 1848 proved that speeches and majority resolutions cannot change anything. The future of Germany will be decided by blood and iron. The whole country went berserk. The king had appointed this maniac who was going to make war. And you ought to also understand, and I shall come to the significance of this in a minute, Bismarck was extremely unpopular with the royal family. The queen hated him, the crown prince Frederick hated him, and the crown princess, the Princess Victoria, the Princess Royal of England, Queen Victoria's favorite child, loathed Bismarck. So Bismarck, the sorcerer, used his magical gifts to manipulate and control a rigid, stubborn, reactionary old gentleman, William I, King of Prussia. Now, if William I had had the decency to die at the biblical 70, he would have died in 1867. And we know for a fact, this is not counterfactual history, that he would have packed his bags as soon as Frederick III took office because they loathed him. But the king did not die in 1867. He did not die in 1877. He did not die in 1887. He died in 1888 at the age of 91. So the relationship between the king and Bismarck went on for 26 years. And it's that personal relationship between Bismarck and his sovereign, between what I think of as father and son, of a rather peculiar kind, which allowed Bismarck to do what he did. So in answer to Mr. Berry's question, it seems to me without biography, you absolutely cannot understand this. And then you have to think about what the relationship was between Bismarck and these people. First, Bismarck's relationship with the Queen, Queen Augusta. Lady Emily Russell, daughter of the Earl of Clarendon, wife of the most brilliant British ambassador in Berlin probably ever, wrote to Queen Victoria the following letter. "The Emperor and Empress have conferred on this embassy the high distinction which no other embassy has ever enjoyed in Berlin. Your Majesty is aware of the political jealousy of Bismarck about the Empress Augusta's influence over the Emperor, which he thinks stands in the way of his anti-clerical and national policy and prevents the formation of responsible ministries as in England. The Empress told my husband that Bismarck has only twice spoken to Her Majesty since the war of 1870, and she expressed a wish that she should dine with us also. According to etiquette, he would have had to sit on the left side of the Empress, and Her Majesty would then have had an hour in which he could not have escaped conversing. Prince Bismarck accepted our invitation, but said he would prefer to set aside etiquette and cede the place to the Austrian ambassador. However, on the day of the dinner, and a short time before the hour appointed, Prince Bismarck sent an excuse saying he was ill with lumbago. The diplomats looked mysterious and hinted his illness being a diplomatic one. Prince Bismarck often expresses his hatred for the Empress in such strong language that my husband is placed in a very difficult position." Unquote. The great Bismarck, who transformed the world, who considered himself an aristocrat and gentleman, and who had in fact excellent manners, could not face a polite chat with a little old lady with a Saxon accent who happened to be his sovereign lady. Think about it. It defies belief. Then Bismarck as a speaker. And this is a remarkable account from the Schwäbische Merkur, a South German paper. "How astonished are those who hear him for the first time. Instead of a powerful and sonorous voice, instead of the expected pathos, instead of a fiery tirade glowing with classical eloquence, the speech flows easily and softly in conversational tones across his lips, hesitates for a while, and winds its way until he finds the right word or phrase and precisely the right expression emerges. One almost feels at the beginning that the speaker suffers from embarrassment. His upper body moves from side to side. He pulls his handkerchief from his back pocket and wipes his brow, puts it back in the pocket, and pulls it out again. This is not the picture of your charismatic speaker." A week later, and this we know because Moritz Busch, one of Bismarck's secretaries, recorded it, he had the following conversation. "The shorthand stenographers," I'm quoting now, "the shorthand stenographers turned against me in connection with my last speech. As long as I was popular, that was not the case. They garbled what I said, so there was no sense in it. When murmurs were heard from the left or the center, they omitted the word left. And when there was applause, they forgot to mention it. The whole bureau acts in the same way. I have complained to the president of parliament. It was that which made me ill. It was like the illness produced by over-smoking, a stuffiness in the head, a giddiness, a disposition to vomit." Unquote. Now think about that for a minute. What is the probability that in the more boring corridors of the Reichstag, a conspiracy of stenographers had emerged to undo the greatest statesman of the 19th century? It's crazy. And yet he believed it. And this fear of conspiracy and enemies is really remarkable. When I began the work on this biography, I saw Bismarck's constant resignation threats, his long stays away from Berlin, his illnesses, his hypochondria, as simply, in part, ingenious tactics to get his way, and they were undoubtedly that too. Now I see more clearly that the physical triangle, psychic triangle rather, between a weak emperor and a strong empress must have given Bismarck constant pain because it reenacted what he had most hated about his childhood, his weak father and his strong mother. And reenacting this kind of psychic triangle would have twisted it again and again to a point beyond endurance. He thus continually reenacted the horrors of his childhood with a cold, ambitious, frightening mother and a feeble, old, ineffectual father still exercising power over him. And had, of course, the king not been weak, Bismarck could not have used the remnants of royal absolutism to make his will felt through the entire political system. But he paid a really terrible price in hypochondria, hysteria, illness, sleeplessness, rage, and overeating. He destroyed much of his social life, the happiness of his children, the friendships of his youth, with the exception of Motley, and his peace of mind. But he dominated society completely. Now, a few little vignettes before I stop talking, because I promised not to talk more than about 35 to 40 minutes. Gluttony. Here is an entry from Christoph von Tiedemann's diary, where he said, "Here we eat until the walls burst." In 1878, Tiedemann recorded a typical evening meal without comment as the entry for that day in his diary. 28 January 1878, menu. Oysters, caviar. Venison soup, trout. Morel mushrooms, smoked breast of goose. Wild boar and Cumberland sauce, saddle of venison. Apple fritters. Cheese and bread, marzipan, chocolate, and apples. And that was a family meal. Bismarck could not control his emotions any more than his appetite. When Sultan, the Reichshund, the Reich dog, died, as one wag called it, of a heart attack at Varzin in October 1877, Bismarck would not be consoled. This is Tiedemann again. "He cannot stop talking about the death of his dog, and especially that he hit him shortly before he died. He tortures himself with the thought that he caused the dog's death because of that. He accuses himself of violent temper, brutality, with which he hurts everybody, people who come into his contact with him, and on berates himself for mourning so long and so deeply for an animal," unquote. As he got older, rage and irritability got worse. Robert Lucius von Balhausen, who became a minister and a member of Bismarck's inner circle in 1870, and after 1879 was a cabinet minister in the Prussian State Ministry, saw Bismarck frequently and recorded this deterioration. As early as 1875, Lucius wrote, 22nd of February, "It's a remarkable feature of Bismarck's character, how intensively he nurses thoughts of revenge and retaliation for real or imagined slights that he suffered. In his morbid irritability, he feels as a wrong what from other persons was never intended to be that." Tiedemann once asked him, "Did your Excellency sleep well last night?" And Bismarck said, "Ich habe die ganze Nacht gehasst. I spent the whole night hating." Bismarck destroyed more than just his health. I think he had a disastrous effect on Germany. Political opponents were enemies, and enemies had to be crushed. In one of his earliest speeches in the lower house in 1863, he explained his view of political conflict. "Constitutional life is a series of compromises. If these are frustrated, conflicts arise. Conflicts are questions of power, and who has power to hand can go his own way." No idea of compromise. He destroyed German liberalism and tried to stamp out the Catholic Center Party. He outlawed social democracy and wanted to deprive socialists and trade unionists of their votes. In January 1884, Edward Lasker, one of Bismarck's most persistent enemies and still worse, a Jew, died on a visit to New York. The House of Representatives, the U.S. House of Representatives, resolved, quote, "This loss is not alone to be mourned by the people of his native land, where his firm and constant exposition of and devotion to free and liberal ideas have materially advanced the social, political, and economic conditions of those people, but also by lovers of liberty throughout the world." When the text of the resolution arrived in Berlin, Bismarck refused to accept it and returned it to the senders because the description was erroneous. Five Prussian cabinet ministers desired to attend Lasker's funeral at the Oranienburg Street Synagogue and asked Bismarck for permission. He replied, "Certainly not." None of them went. Bismarck's will was law. He had a whole series of objective difficulties which he could not overcome, and at the end, even Rohn, his backer, admitted, Bismarck treats business, even the Prussian, more or less as he did years ago. He is in cabinet meetings lively and speaks almost all the time, and falls into the old error that through intellectual liveliness and personal charm, he can overcome all the difficulties in the way. He will flirt with the national liberals and ignore old friends and political comrades. He believes that he can win everybody over by diplomatic dialectic and human cleverness, and to be able to lead them by spreading bait. He talks conservatives to the conservatives and liberal to the liberals, and reveals in this either so sovereign a contempt for his entourage or such incredible illusions that it makes me shudder. He wants to remain in office at any cost and for the present and the future because he feels that the structure he's begun will collapse, making him a laughing stock in the world as soon as he takes his hand away. This is not entirely incorrect, but the means to that end. Are they sanctified for his sake? And this from the most loyal, the most devoted, and the most important person in Bismarck's political career. When Bismarck fell from power in 1890, Rohn's prophecy began to realize itself. The institutions ceased to work. The new young Kaiser wanted to enjoy personal rule and found a group of dedicated courtiers who encouraged his megalomania. The levers which Bismarck had left failed in unsteady hands, and William II took the blame. By that stage, Bismarck had become an icon, the all-wise, all-knowing statesman, and he contributed to that by his bitterness and subterfuge in retirement. Now, I'm going to close with a witness who is impeccable, the great Max Weber, the famous sociologist, the man who invented our concept of charisma in a lecture in 1918. He also wrote the following in 1918 in the introduction to his study of the German state. Bismarck left a nation totally without political education, that is underlined in the original, and totally bereft of political will. It is a custom to expect that the great man at the top would provide their politics for them. And further, as a result of his improper exploitation of monarchical sentiment to conceal his own power, politics, and party battles, it's grown accustomed to submit patiently and fantastically to whatever was decided for it in the name of monarchical government, unquote. I think these conclusions from Weber, perhaps the greatest of all sociologists, suggest that the human self, the personality of the leading actors, must be built into any analysis of complex historical transformations. Who can deny that Gorbachev transformed our world by the sheer power of his personality, or that Bismarck transformed Europe in the way he did because he was Bismarck? His legacy, as Weber noted bitterly, was personal and destructive, and that too was because he was Bismarck. Thank you very much.
Very much. I think we have some time for questions.
Absolutely.
Very good.
Questions are the real fun. Yes.
Do you think it's a coincidence that Italy and Germany unified approximately the same time?
It's not a coincidence. It arises again in both cases as a result of the revolutions of 1848. And now, the Italian case I'm very familiar with, and I could give you an hour's lecture on Carlo Cattaneo, who led the Milanese Revolution. But what happens in 1848, in a way, it's not unlike what happened in the Arab Spring. All of a sudden, bad harvests, uncertainty in government, a cold and miserable winter, people take to the streets. But the difference between the Arab Spring and 1848 was that there was an existing model. Everybody in Europe had in his or her head the French Revolution. They knew what was expected. So what happened in Italy in 1848 and in Germany in 1848, everybody took to the streets. And what did they want? They wanted a constitution. They wanted representative government. They wanted liberty, equality, and fraternity. So all over Europe, these revolutions spread. And everybody in power panicked. As William II of Württemberg said, damals lagen wir alle auf dem Bauch. At that stage, we were all lying flat on our bellies. But unlike the Arab Spring, the forces of order always ultimately had control. The army was aristocratic. It had a problem. It didn't know how to fight, street fight, in an old city where people were dropping chamber pots on them and boring water, and there was a danger that the peasant soldiers would fraternize with the people in the city. So the armies withdrew, they regrouped, and eventually in 1848-49 they crushed the revolution and stamped it out. But in that process, both the Kingdom of Piedmont and the Kingdom of Prussia had got constitutions. And so it's not a coincidence that the two great statesmen who unify the two countries emerge only after 1848. Count Camillo Benso di Cavour, who unified Italy, becomes prime minister of Piedmont in 1852 and basically transforms Piedmont, makes it an English-style liberal monarchy, free trade and all that kind of stuff, anti-clericalism. And it's under him that the Italian revolt of 1859-60 and the war between Austria and France is corralled into a conservative end, and the Kingdom of Italy is taken over by Piedmont. So the model is there even for the Prussians. And Bismarck, who was still an ambassador in 1859, watches that with great interest because he sees two things that happened in the revolutions of 1848 that are important. One is he realizes that democracy can actually support conservatives and not just radicals. And secondly, he saw how Cavour manipulated the situation to unify Italy. And of course, Prussia was in a much stronger case. So there's a direct connection as well, because the Prussians mobilized in 1859 during the Austro-French War, and the mobilization was a mess. And it was such a mess that Moltke decided they had to do something about the army. This in turn then leads to the crisis which brings Bismarck to power. So a long answer to a short question, absolutely no coincidence. The two are both temporally and, if you like, causally connected. And the one in some sense acts as a model for the other. Thank you for the question. Yes?
Did he do an enormous amount of damage to the world by creating this Prussian-German empire?
The short answer is yes. The short answer is yes. And, of course, here you have to be really careful. When the great Kissinger took notice of my modest work and transformed it from an obscure book into a bestseller, there was a brief and kind of hallucinatory moment when I was in the top 100, the Bismarck book was in the top 100 Amazon, above Tina Fey and the diet books. It didn't last. But anyway, his one real objection was that I say there's a direct line between Bismarck and Hitler. There is a direct line, and you can see it in the following ways. The president of the German Republic in 1933 was Paul von Hindenburg and Benningendorff, a Prussian Junker of exactly the type whom Bismarck had preserved. He had gone to a Kadettenanstalt. He had fought in both of Bismarck's wars, 1866 and 1870. And he was a wooden, fairly unimaginative Prussian Junker, and he was president of the Republic. And it was he who put Hitler into power. So in other words, somebody who was trained and formed under Bismarck is in charge of the Weimar Republic when Hitler comes to power. And why is the president, a field marshal, prepared to give Bismarck's office to diesen Böhmischen Gefreite, to this Austrian corporal? Why? Because in the summer of 1932, a man called Schlange Schöningen, who was in Bismarck's, it was in Bruning's cabinet as agriculture minister, began to look into scandals about how subsidies paid to Junker landlords in 1932 had been misused. Hindenburg's Junker friends went to him and said, you can't allow this to happen. You've simply got to get rid of Bruning. It's going to ruin us. And Hindenburg was an estate owner like Oldenburg, Januszau, and the von Tadens, and all of them, gets rid of Bruning. And once that happens, you have to have an election. Hitler gets the big vote that he gets in 1932 and suddenly becomes a real actor. So there is, I think, a direct relationship. The preservation of this class, which absolutely never, ever considered reform, and I don't know why. I mean, the English aristocracy thought, my goodness, universal suffrage may come. Let's make allies of them. Let's give them the vote before they come and take it. The Junkers never did that. So the answer to your question is yes.
No, and you couldn't talk about everything in this one.
Quite.
But I wish you would touch for a moment on the relationship between Bismarck and Bleichwader.
I think I did touch on it. In fact, that's quite a lot, because I used Fritz Stern's book. And one of the...
this evening you did.
Oh, I don't, my goodness. There is so much I didn't talk about. Bismarck is the most interesting character of the 19th century. And there is nothing about Bismarck that I would not talk about. His sense of humor, for example, his hospitality, what he read, his musical tastes, his habits in the countryside, all that. The relationship between Bismarck and Bleichwader is the subject of a 500-page book by the great Fritz Stern. It is a fascinating book. Bismarck, what I will say briefly, is that when Bismarck was ambassador in Frankfurt, he went to dinner one night at the Rothschilds. And I think it was Meyer Anschel Rothschild. And he was very impressed. And he told the then Rothschild head of house that he would be moving to St. Petersburg probably as ambassador, and he'd need somebody in Berlin to look after his affairs. And the Rothschild said, well, Bleichwader is okay. He's our agent there. He's a pretty decent chap. You can go to him. And so Bleichwader becomes Bismarck's banker, with great effect for Bleichwader's own fortune and for Bismarck's own portfolio, because Bismarck was a very, very canny investor. And in the summer of 1865, when it looked like there'd be a war between Austria and Prussia, Bismarck tells Bleichwader to sell my railroads. And as soon as it's clear that there isn't going to be a war, he says to Bleichwader, you can buy him back now. I think that's called insider trading now. Yes, please. Yes.
Father, also a wealthy man, I think came in, also with Henry Morgenthau as his spender or his neighbor from Hudson Valley. I know it's a stretch.
No, it's not a stretch.
The dominant figure of mid 20th century America, who everything swirled around
yeah.
him, and nobody really knew him. Also, a hypochondriac, also died.
I think that's right. Let me just correct one thing you said. I don't think Bismarck was evil. I think Bismarck was immensely complicated. And I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and say, what do I think? Because after all this exposure to Bismarck and his friends, I think in the end he was a disaster because he stayed too long and he left such a legacy. With Roosevelt, there's no doubt. Roosevelt was the most fascinating figure probably in American political history and one of the most impenetrable. Because you forget that he was stricken with polio in 1919, wasn't it? And so he was also, in a way, a very remarkable survivor. But I love reading biographies of Roosevelt and what Francis Perkins said about him and what Harold Ickes said about him, because he is like Bismarck. He's absolutely endlessly fascinating. So I don't think it's a stretch at all. Yes, way in the back. That's a really good question.
It's so unlike
him. Well, it is and it isn't. Bismarck, one of his techniques was always to have two options and sometimes three in any political situation. There is a wonderful irony. The first big crisis in Bismarck's relationship with King William took place in August of 1863. He had had no successes yet. The table at home, the royal table, was full of complaints about Bismarck to the king. The king was always about to get rid of him. The Austrian emperor invited all the princes of Germany to come to a conference to unify the state under Austrian presidency. An invitation from the emperor of Austria to the king of Prussia was a command. It was a feudal state. The king felt his obligation to go to a conference called by his liege lord. Bismarck said, "Your Majesty cannot go. I will not serve as your minister." And they had one of these, the first of these huge father and son rows, both of them in tears, both of them in bed afterwards, exhausted with it. The king did not go. And he then said to Bismarck, "Well, you've done this. The Prussian government has to say something." And Bismarck made a statement on behalf of the Prussian government saying the royal government is not taking part in this conference because there is nothing in it for the German people. The German people must have democratic representation. The whole country was so shocked. The Leipzig paper wrote, "It feels like Mephistopheles has climbed up into the pulpit and is reading the gospel." That's what it felt like. Okay, so that's Bismarck's technique. With the Social Democrats, he was hoist by his own petard. He introduced universal suffrage. How was he to know that Germany was to industrialize and a large working class would emerge? And because of universal suffrage, the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, would become the second largest party in the Reichstag. So he had a problem. And his way of dealing with this was twofold. One, to pass a law in 1878 suppressing the party, but through an omission, he forgot to outlaw them as an electoral vehicle, so they were still elected. And on the other hand, that's the stick. The carrot is to offer them social welfare legislation. And that's quintessentially Bismarck. And as he said to Moritz Busch, well, he said, if you think about a servant in a royal palace, servant in a royal palace is much, much more obedient because a servant in a royal palace expects a pension. So what we have to do for our workers is make sure that they have a pension so they're obedient. And so what he did was to introduce the first compulsory contributory system of sickness, invalid, and old age insurance in modern history. And it's still the basis of the German social welfare state. So what's Bismarck doing? On the one hand, he's trying to suppress and destroy the Social Democratic Party, outlaw them. On the other hand, he's trying to give their constituency a way of separating from the party. He did the same thing with LaSalle, the famous socialist orator. He and LaSalle had a very unusual relationship. Bismarck asked LaSalle to come and see him. And he did it in secret, because how could the chancellor minister president of Prussia in 1864 see a notorious socialist orator? So they met in secret. And what Bismarck had in mind was exactly the same kind of thing. If he could separate the working class vote from the very large liberal party, his opponents, he could weaken them. And he thought LaSalle was the person with his charisma who could do that. How was he to know that LaSalle would get involved in an absolutely crazy duel about some girlfriend and get himself killed? Marx said, only LaSalle would have been capable of such idiocy. And that's true. So that, I think, is the answer to your question. I did not spend enough time in the book on this, partly because I had to make choices. And that is so well known, I thought I'd just simply say that it happened. Perhaps I was wrong. Perhaps I should have spent more time on it. Thank you for the question. Yes, please.
Has your book been translated and published in Germany?
That is a wonderful question. It is in the process of being translated at this moment. And he will tell you something, I guess, about me, that my German translator, every time he does 150-odd pages of a translation, he sends me 20 or 30 pages of corrections, misprints, errors, wrong dates, wrong things. Anyway, I'm delighted, because the book is going to be very controversial in Germany, I think. Yeah, I think it's going to be very controversial. At least the publishers hope it will. And I will be attacked, and I'll have to go and talk to audiences much less friendly than this one. But I don't want them to say, it's a pity this ignorant American didn't know that Forkenbeck has a K in it, you know? And Forkenbeck will have a K. So the answer is yes, it's being translated by the famous old, and be published by the famous old Propyläen Verlag, which used to publish Goethe and is now part of Ullstein. It will be out probably sometime in the fall of 2012. Oh, yes. What the translator has done, he's absolutely amazing. When I had to translate another book, a book I did on Mussolini and his relationship with Hitler, I had to find all the Italian quotes and put them back in the book. But Klaus-Dieter Schmidt has them all. And that's why he says, wait a minute, this says it's on page 63. Not in my edition, it isn't. Yes, please, Irv.
Does it have anything to do with naming, you know, the Bismarck ship?
Yes, indeed. Hitler used Bismarck. He used Bismarck, he used Tirpitz, he used Scharnhorst. The pocket battleships, the small battleships of the German Navy, were all named after great figures. And in the case of the Tirpitz, Wolfgang von Tirpitz, whom I love, is a wonderful man, the son of the admiral, was actually invited to the launch. And being a strong anti-Nazi, he took a knife in his tunic. He was then a man in his 50s. He had it to kill Hitler. And he stood on the platform next to Hitler for an hour and a half with this knife there. And he said to me, I have three sons. And people like me don't kill people. We might shoot at them in a war, but you can't. I couldn't do it, and I regret it to this day. Well, there you are. Anyway, so the Bismarck, the Tirpitz, the Scharnhorst, these were all named after great figures in Prusso-German history. So it was perfectly normal to have a Bismarck. Yes, please, in the back.
I need to take you away from Bismarck, but can you comment about the current situation in Europe and where they're going, possibly?
In my profession, you comment on everything. We are paid to be irresponsible, I guess. The situation in Europe is really, really serious. In effect, the euro acts as a kind of gold standard. Everybody's tied to a fixed exchange. And if your economy begins not to function very badly, you can't get out of it. You can't devalue. The situation that's happened with the Greeks is that the more they cut, the more pensions they reduce, the more the GDP falls, the gross domestic product falls, the harder it is to pay back the debts, the more the debt becomes a proportion of gross domestic product. It's a vicious circle and it's going down. We had lunch with an old friend of mine who is in the business, and he told us that the view in his firm is that the Germans, who basically call the shots here, want this to reach a point at which it is so obvious that the only solution is a controlled devaluation, a repudiation of debt, that it will then be taken with a huge sigh of relief by the world, and the speculators won't try to undermine it. Now, I don't know whether that is Angela Merkel's strategy. I do have a tremendous amount of respect for her, and I feel a bit guilty about making a joke at her expense at the beginning of my talk, because she's been a remarkable figure. Nobody would have foreseen her lasting so long and being so good at what she does. But she's very, very shrewd. And I have my fingers crossed, because I think for everybody in the Western world, it's essential that the European Union continue to function, that the euro be saved, that we don't have a crisis which will spread from the collapse of French banks and Spanish banks and Italian banks to us anyway. But how did the market close? Did it continue to go down all day? This is great. How did it end? Almost 400 points down. I mean, and they're scared. And they're scared because nobody knows what the chain reaction would be if we have a disorderly default. If we have an orderly default, whatever that means, the euro can be saved. My own feeling, having lived in Europe a very long time and going often to Germany and to other parts of Europe, the European Union is deeply ingrained in people's awareness. And it is one of those things which people don't talk about much, but in spite of all its faults, and they are many, and the so-called democratic deficit, which is also a flaw, people believe in it. And I understand, I haven't seen them myself, but our guest at lunch said that the latest opinion polls in Germany suggest that the majority of the German people realize that they've got to bail out the Greeks. Why? Because it's the survival of the euro which gives them their competitive advantage. If they have to go back to the mark, it'll happen in 1970 all over again, when the mark will go up through the stratosphere, and that'll be the end of their export business. So they have a strong interest in maintaining stability in the euro. That's my reading of events. It is very unexpert, and it's only as informed as what I get out of the Financial Times, if I could get the Financial Times to be delivered again to my door in the morning, which for the last 2 weeks I've not succeeded in doing. Any more questions? Are you all had enough? Yes, please.
You mentioned early on, and that it was referred to again, that Bismarck had a strong mother.
Yeah.
And this might have been what started him off and so on. Was that what started him off, and did he have any further inspiration or strength or comfort in his personal life later on?
That is a wonderful question. And there are about 400 pages of trying to answer it. But let me say a word about the mother. I think the one really original thing in this biography, nobody's done this before, I took a long look at who Wilhelmina Mencken was. And I got to her in a very oblique way. Henry Kissinger's model in the early 19th century was a man called Friedrich Gentz. And Friedrich Gentz was a smart young man, very ambitious, who translated Edmund Burke's criticism of the French Revolution into German, made it a bestseller, and got very famous. And through looking at what Gentz said and wrote in the 1790s, I came to see the importance of Bismarck's maternal grandfather, a man called Anastasius Ludwig Mencken, who was a civil servant in the Prussian civil service, very brilliant, very enlightened, out of favor under Frederick William II, but in favor with Frederick William III, who came to the throne in 1797. Gentz said, he's the coming man. And in Gentz's letters, you get a lot about Bismarck's grandfather. Mencken becomes chief of the cabinet. He is, in effect, the most important civil servant in the Prussian kingdom. Frederick William III was very insecure, and he relied on this brilliant civil servant. That is Bismarck's grandfather. So Wilhelmina Mencken was born into a highly successful family. In 1800, at the age of 49, Anastasius Ludwig Mencken dies suddenly. Now, if you're a Jane Austen reader, you'll know what happens to a gentlewoman without money. One of Bismarck's female cousins said, "Poor Wilhelmina, no fun, i.e. no title, no money." So she's like Jane in Emma. She's a gentlewoman without anything. She's 13 years old when her father dies, a terribly vulnerable age. So she has to get married to somebody. And when she's 16, or I think 17, she marries Ferdinand von Bismarck, Bismarck's father, the least accomplished, the least interesting of four Bismarck brothers, who has an estate, and he's a character right out of Henry Fielding. You know, he's a country squire, an eccentric, the kind of person who has four barometers and goes around tapping them to see if they're working. And there's a wonderful letter from Bismarck to his sister. You asked a question which is near to my heart, in which Bismarck says, "Don't write Dad anything about your ideas. He likes facts. Tell him, are the windows leaking? How are the horses? What's the temperature outside? What do you get to eat?" That is the person that Wilhelmina is stuck with, right? She has two sons, Bernhard and Otto. Bernhard is okay, but no great shakes. Otto is something special. So on Otto, she turns her attention. He is going to fulfill all the things that her sainted, much lamented father did not accomplish. And Bismarck hates her. She's very tough on him, and she's very cold. She's very distant. She's very beautiful and very, very unmaternal. And so there's a constant tug of war between him and this strong lady, and I think that leaves its mark on him the rest of his life. The rest of Bismarck's love life, which is again very interesting and I would love to talk about, I will have to leave at this point because you've been terribly patient up to now. I think I better stop while I'm ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.